He had never spoken to her again about Cheryl, but he had started coming to her office more often than usual. He had stopped her in the halls for snatches of pointless discussions. And such moments had grown into a sum that gave her an incomprehensible sensation, as if while clinging to her for support and protection against some nameless terror, his arms were sliding to embrace her and to plunge a knife into her back. "I'm eager to know your views," he was saying insistently as she looked away. "It is most urgent that we discuss the situation, and you haven't said anything." She did not turn. "It's not as if there were no money to be had out of the railroad business, but..." She glanced at him sharply. His eyes scurried away. "What I mean is, some constructive policy has to be devised," he droned on hastily. "Something has to be done. By somebody. In times of emergency." She knew what thought he had scurried to avoid, what hint he had given her, yet did not want her to acknowledge or discuss. She knew no train schedules could be maintained any longer, no promises kept, no contracts observed, that regular trains were canceled at a moment's notice and transformed into emergency specials, sent by unexplained orders to unexpected destinations, and that the orders came from Cuffy Meggs, sole judge of emergencies and of the public welfare. She knew that factories were closing, some with their machinery stilled for lack of supplies that had not been received, others with their warehouses full of goods that could not be delivered. She knew that the old industries, the giants who had built their power by a purposeful course projected over a span of time, were left to exist at the whim of the moment, a moment they could not foresee or control. She knew that the best among them, those of the longest range and most complex function, had long since gone. And those still struggling to produce, struggling savagely to preserve the code of an age when production had been possible, were now inserting into their contracts a line shameful to a descendant of Nat Taggart. Transportation permitting. And yet there were men, and she knew it, who were able to obtain transportation whenever they wished, as by a mystic secret, as by the grace of some power which one was not to question or explain. They were the men whose dealings with Cuffy Meggs were regarded by people as that unknowable of mystic creeds which smites the observer for the sin of looking. So people kept their eyes closed, dreading not ignorance but knowledge. She knew that deals were made whereby those men sold a commodity known as transportation pull, a term which all understood but none would dare define. She knew that these were the men of the emergency specials, the men who could cancel her scheduled trains and send them to any random spot of the continent which they chose to strike with their voodoo stamp, the stamp superseding contract, property, justice, reason, and lives, the stamp stating that the public welfare required the immediate salvation of that spot. These were the men who sent trains to the relief of the Smather brothers and their grapefruit in Arizona, to the relief of a factory in Florida engaged in the production of pinball machines, to the relief of a horse farm in Kentucky, to the relief of Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel. These were the men who made deals with desperate industrialists to provide transportation for the goods stalled in their warehouses, or failing to obtain the percentage demanded, made deals to purchase the goods when the factory closed at the bankruptcy sale at 10 cents on the dollar, and to speed the goods away in freight cars suddenly available, away to markets where dealers of the same kind were ready for the kill. These were the men who hovered over factories waiting for the last breath of a furnace to pounce upon the equipment, and over desolate sidings to pounce upon the freight cars of undelivered goods. These were a new biological species, the hit-and-run businessmen, who did not stay in any line of business longer than the span of one deal, who had no payrolls to meet, no overhead to carry, no real estate to own, no equipment to build, whose only asset and sole investment consisted of an item known as friendship. These were the men whom official speeches described as the progressive businessman of our dynamic age, but whom people called the pull peddlers. The species included many breeds, those of transportation pull, and of steel pull, and oil pull, and wage raise pull, and suspended sentence pull. Men who were dynamic, who kept darting all over the country while no one else could move. Men who were active and mindless, active not like animals, but like that which breeds, feeds, and moves upon the stillness of a corpse. She knew that there was money to be had out of the railroad business, and she knew who was now obtaining it. Cuffy Meggs was selling trains as he was selling the last of the railroad's supplies, whenever he could rig a setup which would not let it be discovered or proved, selling rail to roads in Guatemala or to trolley companies in Canada, selling wire to manufacturers of jukeboxes, selling cross ties for fuel in resort hotels. Did it matter, she thought, looking at the map, which part of the corpse had been consumed by which type of maggot? By those who gorged themselves, or by those who gave the food to other maggots? So long as living flesh was prey to be devoured, did it matter whose stomachs it had gone to fill? There was no way to tell which devastation had been accomplished by the humanitarians and which by undisguised gangsters. There was no way to tell which acts of plunder had been prompted by the charity lust of the Lawsons and which by the gluttony of Cuffy Meggs. No way to tell which communities had been immolated to feed another community 1 week closer to starvation, and which to provide yachts for the pool peddlers. Did it matter? Both were alike in fact, as they were alike in spirit. Both were in need, and need was regarded as sole title to property. Both were acting in strictest accordance with the same code of morality. Both held the immolation of men as proper, and both were achieving it. There wasn't even any way to tell who were the cannibals and who were the victims. The communities that accepted as their rightful due the confiscated clothing or fuel of a town to the east of them found next week their granaries confiscated to feed a town to the west. Men had achieved the ideal of the centuries. They were practicing it in unobstructed perfection. They were serving need as their highest ruler, need as first claim upon them, need as their standard of value, as the coin of their realm, as more sacred than right and life. Men had been pushed into a pit where, shouting that man is his brother's keeper, each was devouring his neighbor and was being devoured by his neighbor's brother. Each was proclaiming the righteousness of the unearned and wondering who was stripping the skin off his back. Each was devouring himself, while screaming in terror that some unknowable evil was destroying the earth. What complaint do they now have to make? She heard Hugh Axton's voice in her mind. That the universe is irrational? Is it? She sat looking at the map, her glance dispassionately solemn, as if no emotion save respect were permissible when observing the awesome power of logic. She was seeing, in the chaos of a perishing continent, the precise mathematical execution of all the ideas men had held. They had not wanted to know that this was what they wanted. They had not wanted to see that they had the power to wish, but not the power to fake. And they had achieved their wish to the letter, to the last blood-stained comma of it. What were they thinking now, the champions of need and the lechers of pity, she wondered. What were they counting on? Those who had once simpered, I don't want to destroy the rich, I only want to seize a little of their surplus to help the poor, just a little, they'll never miss it. Then later had snapped, the tycoons can stand being squeezed, they've amassed enough to last them for 3 generations. Then later had yelled, why should the people suffer while businessmen have reserves to last a year? Now we're screaming, why should we starve while some people have reserves to last a week? What were they counting on, she wondered. You must do something, cried James Taggart. She whirled to face him. I? It's your job, it's your province, it's your duty. What is? To act, to do. To do what? How should I know? It's your special talent. You're the doer. She glanced at him. The statement was so oddly perceptive and so incongruously irrelevant. She rose to her feet. Is this all, Jim?
No, no, I want a discussion.
Go ahead.
But you haven't said anything.
You haven't either.
But what I mean is there are practical problems to solve, which, for instance, what was that matter of our last allocation of new rail vanishing from the storehouse in Pittsburgh?
Cuffy Meggs stole it and sold it.
Can you prove it?
He snapped defensively. Have your friends left any means, methods, rules, or agencies of proof?
Then don't talk about it. Don't be theoretical. We've got to deal with facts. We've got to deal with facts as they are today. I mean, we've got to be realistic and devise some practical means to protect our supplies under existing conditions, not under unprovable assumptions, which...
She chuckled. There was the form of the formless, she thought. There was the method of his consciousness. He wanted her to protect him from Cuffy Meggs without acknowledging Meggs's existence, to fight it without admitting its reality, to defeat it without disturbing its game.